they found one of the four passengers was alive. And then they immediately started mounting to organize an effort to get her out of the plane.
A plane crash near Angoon claims three lives. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the heavy lift of trying to balance the state budget.
It is a life or death situation that we do not leave the Senate without a plan that puts the state on a path toward closing the fiscal gap.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
A plane registered to Sunrise Aviation, a Wrangell-based charter airline, crashed on Admiralty Island today. Four people were traveling on the Cessna 206 between Wrangell and Angoon. Only one female passenger survived, said a search and rescue official. The Coast Guard received an emergency alert in the morning, indicating the aircraft was in distress. A Coast Guard helicopter located the downed plane 20 miles southeast of Angoon, but was unable to land due to turbulent winds. Members of Sitka Mountain Rescue were called in to hike to the scene. Captain Lance Yores said the team was dropped off 600 yards below the wreckage, which is located in snowy alpine terrain.
To everybody's disbelief, they found one of the four passengers was alive. And then they immediately started mounting to organize an effort to get her out of the plane back down to where they could safely insert her into the helicopter.
Yores is helping guide the team remotely from Sitka. The female survivor is being medevaced to Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau. Her medical condition is unknown at this time. State business licensing documents for Sunrise Aviation identify two owners, Tyler Robinson and David Gala. Both are listed with Wrangell mailing addresses. FAA records show that both men are licensed commercial pilots. Proposals to spend permanent fund earnings on the state budget will be a major focus of the legislative session's final 9 days. Leading lawmakers say the outcome could be a combination of bills proposed by Governor Bill Walker, Anchorage Republican Senator Liesl McGuire, and Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hawker. McGuire says it appears that majorities in both houses want to make lasting changes, which she says will strengthen the permanent fund for the future.
It is a life or death situation that we do not leave the Senate without a plan that puts the state on a path toward closing the fiscal gap.
McGuire says the state's economic future depends on bringing certainty to the state budget. While she supports spending cuts, the senator says cutting much deeper would cost jobs and harm needed services.
What you're starting to see already is a chilling effect in the marketplace. You have Alaskan residents, certainly my district and other districts, talking about accelerating the sale of their homes, not making business investments in their capital spend.
The particular elements of the final bill remain unclear. A major decision is whether to include Walker's plan to spend a set amount each year. McGuire and Hawker have instead proposed drawing 4.5% to 5% of the fund's market value annually. With just over a week left in the legislative session, lawmakers are wrangling over the always contentious issue of oil taxes. Governor Bill Walker requested a complete overhaul of the state's oil and gas tax credit program. The House Resources Committee significantly scaled back that proposal. Now a third committee has weighed in. The House Finance Committee chose a middle route, while also introducing some changes that weren't even in the governor's bill. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz has been following the debate. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Lori.
So where do we stand right now?
Well, the numbers are kind of squishy, but if you look out at fiscal year 2018, so this is a year out, the governor's plan would raise or save about $400 million. House Resources, which was the first committee to weigh in, theirs would have saved less than $100 million. And now House Finances saves in the $100 million to $150 million range. So it's sort of in between, but nowhere near what the governor is asking for.
What's new in this current bill?
Well, so the governor's bill would have repealed some credits and it would have raised the minimum tax on the North Slope. And House Finance has moved beyond scaling back credits. It's actually now tinkering with some of the core structures of the existing tax system. So, for instance, the House Finance bill would sunset incentives for so-called new oil. So this is a really key part of our current tax structure is lower taxes on new oil. And the House Finance bill would actually say, look, after 5 years, it's no longer new oil. It goes back to being charge the same amount as legacy fields like Prudhoe Bay or Kuparuk.
Oil taxes are complicated, and even a lot of lawmakers don't totally understand them. What's the big picture here?
Yeah, so the big philosophical question really is, do you think the state is getting its money's worth from these credits? So the governor and his administration would argue no. You know, especially at low prices, they say we're paying too much money. We don't need to pay, for instance, 65% of the cost of a well to make it attractive to drill. And some of these credits, like the ones in Cook Inlet, were really designed in response to very specific crises that they say have passed. We're no longer worried about a natural gas shortage. So, you know, it's okay to scale back those credits, they would say, without a huge impact on the state. But, you know, lawmakers say, look, these credits are an investment in more oil. And if you scale it back, you might have less exploration and development, and then you might have less oil 10 or 20 years down the line. So they want to be much more cautious about it.
All right. What's next in the process?
Well, you can think of the bill as sort of being in stop 2 of 6 in the legislature. So it's already gone through House Resources. Right now, it's in front of House Finance. Then it goes to the House floor, then Senate Resources, Senate Finance, the Senate floor. If the two bills are different, it goes to the conference committee and then the governor. So at this point, really all we know is that the bill is certain to change.
Thanks, Rachel, for that update.
Yeah, thanks, Lori.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, breaking through barriers with photography in rural Alaska.
They say no, you know, I'm usually kind of bummed, but if I was just living my day-to-day life, somebody stopped me with all their camera equipment and asked to take a portrait, I'd be like,
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
The Alaska Senate passed a bill yesterday to allow people to carry concealed firearms on University of Alaska campuses. Bill sponsor, Fairbanks Republican Pete Kelly, says students would be safer if there were more guns on campus. Kelly quoted professors from other countries who opposed the measure.
Well, if I'd have known this was going to be the case, I never would have taken this job. Or if this bill is enacted, I'm considering quitting. Now, almost everyone that heard that, good old-fashioned Americans, the same thought was going through their mind because I talked to them later, and repeat after me, don't let the screen door hit you, you know the rest of the phrase.
University leaders asked legislators to amend the bill so the university maintained more of its ability to regulate guns. While Kelly agreed to some amendments, he opposed others. Anchorage Democratic Senator Berta Gardner opposed the bill. She noted that the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia recognized that firearm restrictions in schools and government buildings were legitimate.
The University of Alaska is a government building. It's also a school. The Alaska State Capitol is a government building. We ban weapons in this building. Why do we think it's incumbent upon us to not allow or trust the Board of Regents to regulate their buildings in the same way we regulate our own?
The vote was 13-5. Majority Caucus Senators Click Bishop of Fairbanks, Lyman Hoffman of Bethel, and Gary Stevens of Kodiak joined Juneau Democratic Senator Dennis Egan and Gardner in opposing the bill. The House Education Committee will hear the bill next. As the legislature's conference committee hashes out the state's operating budget for the upcoming fiscal year, the University of Alaska is standing by, waiting to see just how large the fiscal dent will be. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Depending on legislative action, the University of Alaska will face between a $50 million and $75 million budget shortfall this year. That leads to one commonly asked question of UA President Jim Johnson. Is there more that you can cut?
Of course there's more that could be cut. At the same time, every single program, every degree, every single service that we provide meets a need to some extent, number one. And number two, there's a constituency for it. We didn't make up these programs.
So far, nearly 60 academic programs are on track for elimination, with another 24 under consideration. And as the university whittles down academic programs and other services, jobs are affected as well. 130 positions have been cut through layoffs or attrition, and almost 170 more are impacted by furloughs. Depending on the legislature's funding decisions, those numbers could grow substantially. And Johnson says with each staff reduction comes a direct economic impact extending beyond the university.
But there's a trade-off with every single one of them. You can say, cut the bureaucracy. Okay, well, what does that mean? That's, pick a number, 200 people who are not going to be shopping at Fred Meyer's anymore, or Safeway, or wherever. They're not going to buy cars at Kendall's anymore, or wherever. They're going to leave the state, whatever it might be. It has a major economic impact.
Johnson says if the cuts are more gradual, the university should be able to take a more measured approach to its reductions. But if the cuts skew toward the higher end of the spectrum, Johnson says that might not be the case.
We wouldn't have the luxury of the time to consciously, carefully weigh these trade-offs. We would simply have to make some decisions, tough decisions, very quickly in order to hit these numbers in the coming fiscal year, with some serious impact, certainly, on our ability to serve the state's needs.
Aside from operating budget cuts, Johnson says he's not optimistic about the funding situation in the capital budget. The Board of Regents asked for nearly $35 million to complete construction of UAF's engineering building. Governor Bill Walker, however, did not include funding for the project in his proposed capital budget. The partially built engineering building currently costs the university $1.4 million per year to maintain. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The small community of Ambler was buzzing all day as dog teams pulled in for a rest roughly 200 miles into the Kobuk 440. As KNOM's Emily Schwing reports, dog teams have roughly 240 miles of travel ahead, and it's still anybody's race.
He's still in front of me.
As the mid-morning sun beat down over Ambler, a group of local kids helped haul drop bags and straw for Catherine Keith and Noah Burmeister. The two mushers arrived within an hour of each other in the tiny Northwest Arctic village. Keith told her competitor she was sure he'd eventually pull ahead of her team.
Who's going to win the race?
Your dog.
He's still in front of me.
Both mushers set about feeding and bedding down their dogs. Despite dropping one in Selowik, Burmeister says he's pleased with how his team's running so far.
I like how they're looking. They're looking good and cruising along nice, so no, I'm just looking ahead. I'll worry about what's behind me if they pass me.
Catherine Keith says she's also happy with her team's performance.
I love these guys. They got great attitudes. I think that's so important in a race, so I love it.
Keith and her partner John Baker recently bought out a kennel run by Kelly Maxner in Big Lake, so she's still getting to know new dogs. She arrived in Ambler in third place, but she says she's not convinced she can hold on to that spot.
There's a lot of nice teams here, but yeah, I can't really predict quite yet who's gonna win.
From Selowik, teams traveled more than 80 miles to Ambler. Keith says the trail was soft and punchy in places.
What I'm hoping is here and through Kobuk, there's gonna be such a good snow machine trail that it should be a pretty nice, kind of like easy traveling conditions. But I think here over land to Selowik, it's not as commonly traveled, so I think that's why it was a little, mushy. Yeah.
The stop in Ambler was well-timed. Half the field arrived before the sun rose high, with plans to rest through most of the early afternoon. Avoiding the midday heat could help keep dogs from becoming dehydrated. Mushers have to rest their teams for a cumulative 20 hours in checkpoints along the trail. Most had already accumulated between 4 and 5 hours of rest by the time they reached Ambler. But Nicholas Petit arrived with only 2.5 hours of rest on his team.
That's usually kind of my plan in races, just because when they're full of piss and vinegar, it's kind of hard to hold them back. But I like resting in the day and running at night. So I figured cut it short back there a little bit and pull in here before the sun comes out.
He says he might have an advantage as the rabbit in this year's race.
Yeah, I mean, from the start, I got away from everybody, and that's kind of nice because I think all their dogs chased each other, using more energy in the sun, and mine were just doing their own thing, so.
From Ambler, teams have two relatively short runs to Shungnak and on to Kobuk, where they'll turn around. Most are likely to take another long rest when they return to Ambler before they tackle a second long 80-plus mile stretch to Kiana. On the Kobuk 440 trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Ambler.
A whaling crew from Savoonga landed its second bowhead of the season this week. The St. Lawrence Island community has been working nonstop to haul the whale out of the icy waters, harvest its meat, and distribute it around the village. KNOM's Emily Russell reports.
For the last few weeks, whaling crews have been camped out on the southwest side of St. Lawrence Island. Elvin Nungwook was on the crew that landed Savoonga's first whale in 1972. Sitting around his kitchen table, the elder says they've been going to the same spot ever since.
Now we call that the whaling camp Boorilluk. That's where we're doing whaling now in springtime.
On March 27th of this year, Carl Pelwick Jr. landed the first whale of the season and the earliest in Savoonga's whaling history. Warmer ocean temperatures and stronger winds from the north make it easier for whalers to start their hunts earlier. A week later, on April 5th, Pelwick and his crew, which includes Michael Kralik and Nathaniel O'Connor, harpooned their second bowhead. With the help of 8 other boats, they hauled the whale up to shore and got to work. Elvin Nungwook says nothing goes to waste.
We take everything from the heads and to the fluke, baling, and the meat.
The work is nonstop. A steady stream of snow machiners travel back and forth between camp for days, delivering processed whale and swapping out tired workers with well-rested ones. Brianne Glogergan is a health aide at Savoonga's clinic. She made the trip out to camp to watch it all unfold. Glogergan says, along with the days it takes to harvest a whale, it's also pretty costly for the community.
There's the fuel for the boat. You have grub for camp to be there for a couple of weeks. Fuel for your snow machine to get down there. It's about 38 miles down from here to down there.
But she says the taste of fresh whale makes it all worth it.
It was so yummy.
Even after the meat makes it into people's mouths, the work doesn't let up. George Nungwook is Elvin Nungwook's cousin. He was also on Savoonga's first whaling crew and now acts as the community's commissioner on the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. He says prep for the whaling season starts thousands of miles from home.
In order for us to go whaling, we first need to go to Washington, D.C.
Nungwook says there's a lot of politicking needed to make sure Alaska's 11 whaling communities can feed themselves throughout the year.
It takes a lot of coordination, it takes a lot of people to work together to achieve that goal. It's a lot of work and a lot of legwork. So,
the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission meets 4 times each year. Their work helps inform the International Whaling Commission, or IWC, which meets every 6 years to set worldwide whaling quotas. Nungwook says it's a complicated process and not without its problems.
Oftentimes our quota is used as a political football between non-whaling nations and whaling nations.
That's exactly what happened in 1978 when the IWC failed to pass a quota. Nungwook says those were dark days for Savoonga. So after the IWC reestablished the quota, he says he makes sure the community follows all IWC protocols and fills out all the right paperwork.
You just have to keep plugging away if we want to survive, yeah.
Like the whale harvest itself, Nungwook says his work as a commissioner is tiring and time-consuming, but he says he'll keep at it to keep the tradition alive. Reporting in Savoonga, I'm Emily Russell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program,
APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, rural photography. From Teller in Kaktovik to Shugnak in Tuliksak, Inupiaq photographer Brian Adams has traveled all over rural Alaska for his project, I Am Inuit. As KNOM's Laura Kregel reports, Adams aims to document Inuit culture and share it with the world through portraits and stories of Alaska.
3, 1, 2, and 3. Cool, thanks.
Brian Adams is a photographer. He grew up in Girdwood, outside of Anchorage, and he traveled to his dad's hometown of Kivalina as a kid on family vacations. But he really fell in love with the village as an adult.
I went to Kivalina also in 2005 for my grandma's funeral. I brought a couple cameras and, like, you know, got into the community, was really close to the community. Making photos was just, like, so much fun there. After that trip, I was just like, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to keep coming to the villages. I want to make a body of work of this. It was, you know, a changing point for me.
Now, with I Am Inuit, Adams does just that. He documents the life and people of villages across Alaska.
Most people, especially in Inuit culture, I'm finding, they're not used to talking about themselves.
Today, Adams is in White Mountain.
So, I'm getting people to warm up. Feel free to talk about themselves. It can be semi-challenging at times, but once you get them going, they're pretty excited, and you can tell a lot of people are very proud of their livelihood and where they live.
Adams only has 3 or 4 days in each community he visits, so he gets to work fast, walking around town and trying to meet as many people as he can.
I try not to be pushy at all, you know? I want people to be as comfortable as possible with me, especially while taking photos. I feel like they're really giving me something whenever I get a portrait. So they say no, you know, I'm usually kind of bummed, but at the same time, it's like I totally understand. Because if I was just living my day-to-day life, somebody stopped me with all their camera equipment and asked to take a portrait, I'd be like,
Adams does strike out when he asks to interview the cashier at the White Mountain Native store. Eventually, though, he has better luck when he bumps into Carl Ashenfelter, a customer who's there to buy coffee.
A-S-H. E-N-F-E-L.
Ashenfelter is an elder, and he grew up in White Mountain. This morning, he says he's in no rush, so he gives Adams a few minutes for an interview and a photo.
So you'd be Inupiaq?
I'm 3/4 Eskimo and 1/4, I guess, German.
German? Oh, wow.
Yeah, Ashenfelter.
Oh, wow.
Right there in the store, as employees stock shelves and price goods, Ashenfelter tells Adams about his life. How he's seen the climate change, how much his grandchildren mean to him, even how he defines wisdom. He shares a lot with Adams, but not everything.
Tell me more about your art. So you said you're a painter?
I can carve, I can paint, yeah. I can do just about anything, really.
Yeah.
But I don't do it anymore. There's a long story behind that.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
No.
No?
Okay.
As the interview wraps up, they head outside to do photos in the natural light. Adams has Ashenfelter stand for 2 portraits, one in front of the native store and another along the roadside, as snow machines buzz by.
3, 1, 2, and 3.
Thank you, sir. Cool. Nice to meet you.
Thanks.
Coffee in hand, Ashenfelter says goodbye and leaves to go about his day. Meanwhile, Adams takes a quick coffee break himself before getting back to work. Walking around White Mountain, meeting the people who live there, and asking them to share their stories. I'm Laura Kregel in White Mountain.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, 49 Voices heads to the Beartooth Theater in Anchorage, where Alaska Public Media's Indie Alaska program held a screening last week. They made a short movie with Alaskans willing to answer a few questions in front of the camera.
One of my favorite things about Alaska, I mean, you could say it's beautiful, it's this, it's that, but it's the people.
1979, when this was Flapjack Jim's, I started at the record store just right next door, Odyssey Records and Tape. Everything went belly up, took my severance pay and bought a gold mine, used that for the down payment of my home, and that was 35 years ago.
When I meet people who don't live here, and everyone, the first thing everyone always asks you is like, oh, I know this person who lives in Anchorage or who lives in Alaska, do you know them? And while that might be like a really bogus question to ask someone in like New York City or LA, the chances that you know another person up here are actually like pretty high.
You've heard the expression, sourdough is a person who's soured on the country but doesn't have the dough to leave. Well, I have a twist on that, and that's I'm sort of an April 1st person. I came on April 1st and was foolish enough to stay for 50 years. Tomorrow is my 50th anniversary of being in Alaska.
After a couple different summers working up here, it was actually like a physical like breakup, is how I describe it. Like whenever I had to cross the border and go back down to the lower 48 and that kind of thing. Honestly, I kid you not, it was like this. You're crossing the border and I like felt like this like heart pangs, and I was like, oh my God, it's not you, it's me, just give me more time. And then I realized, I was like, I want to live in Alaska. So I moved up a couple years ago and have not looked back. It's been a really good decision.
Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Laura Craigle, Casey Ellington, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Josh Edge and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Ambler, and Emily Russell on St. Lawrence Island. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.